Welcome back to the Wise Athletes Podcast. For episode number 68, I managed to get Dr. Mike T. Nelson, creator of the Flex Diet and Phys Flex certification programs, back onto our podcast. You may remember Dr. Mike from last year's episode number 32. Dr. Mike has a PhD in exercise physiology, among many other credentials, and he is a super smart guy who walks the walk. Dr. Mike is a middle-aged, high-end strength athlete who loves to kite surf, lift heavy shit, and take ice baths, but more importantly, Dr. Mike is an expert in the science and practice of becoming stronger and fitter despite getting older. Becoming anti-fragile means to become stronger through chaos, so not just building resilience, but actually becoming stronger to resist the increasing forces that seek to tear us down. Listen in as Dr. Mike talks about his work in restoring and leveraging metabolic and physiologic flexibility to drive athletic performance and improve body composition. Dr. Mike also gives us his take on the question of on how much protein we should eat and how to balance maintaining muscle mass while enabling breakdown and recycling of aging cells. This is a good one. All right, let's talk to Dr. Mike. Dr. Mike T. Nelson, welcome back to the Wise Athletes Podcast.
Hi, good to see you guys again. Thank you so much for having me back. I guess the first one wasn't a complete poo show, so I guess I'm back again.
Yes.
Well, welcome back. It's great to have you.
Yeah, it was great. And I've been listening to you ever since, actually well before that, and then ever since as well. And I know that you've evolved your thinking around the metabolic flexibility concept that you've talked so much about. And now you've got this physiologic flexibility thing. Definitely want to hear more about that. Just as a reminder to you, the audience here is the older athlete. So these are not people who are couch potatoes who need to be convinced that exercise is important or they need to watch their diet. These are people who are, they're looking for answers. They're trying, heck, some of them may be working out too much and their diets might be too extreme, and but they're really looking for answers. So much of what's available out on the internet is for elite athletes or younger people, and the studies tend to be of college kids or, that kind of a thing. And so there's, that's why we put this podcast together, was so that we could give answers to the older athlete that's suited to the older athlete. And the word that I've heard you mention before that I want to make the centerpiece to this discussion is anti-fragile.
Yes.
Why don't we let you tell us, remind our audience a little bit about your background and what you do, and then we'll get into it.
Yeah, so a short version of my background is I did a Bachelor of Arts, Natural Science, minor in Chemistry and Math, then decided to go into engineering. So I did 2 years postgraduate work at Michigan Tech, and then I ended up doing 2.5 years there for a master's in mechanical engineering, did mostly biomechanics work. Built a system to microwave the crap out of monkeys, and the military did that later to verify it.
Scary.
So it was more in biomedical research. I got done, and I started working for a cardiovascular company, which I worked for them for about 10 years. And then I'm like, I went back to school again, started doing a PhD in biomedical engineering, dropped out of that, and went over and did exercise physiology. And at the same time, I started training clients primarily in person, and then later transitioned to online. And I finished my PhD in technically in kinesiology, exercise phys, looking at the concepts of metabolic flexibility and heart rate variability. And right now I am an associate professor at the Carrig Institute. They do clinical neuroscience, clinical neurology. And then I have my own business where I work with clients one-on-one, have a couple of certifications, teach part-time for Rocky Mountain University and a bunch of other stuff. So it's been pretty fun.
So go ahead. Well, I was just going to say, not that I'm shocked because I know who you are, but we've got an expert on the line here, which is always my favorite. And you're one of those, there's really very few guys like you out there who are not just really bright and deep into the science here, but you're also like a muscular fellow. You're a physically active, strong human being, and you're smart, and you are applying your smarts to the sorts of things that we're interested in knowing about. So glad to have you on.
Yeah, thank you for that. I do primarily been doing more grip training for about the last 10 years. My goal is to lift the Thomas Dinch dumbbell. So imagine a 175-pound dumbbell that's all cast, like one piece, like the old school dumbbells you see. And the handle is 2 3/8 inch. So like the size of a pop can.
Wow.
So it's not so much the weight picking up, like 175 for one hand deadlift is not super heavy, but the grip on it is so wide that as soon as you pick the thing up, the rotational force, just it just spins out of your hand. So it's getting the grip strength to do that. So I've got smaller bells. I can do a 100-pound one right now. I'm almost at the 135. I'll probably get that this year. So you just got to add 40 pounds to that. So my goal is to get there. A stretch goal is maybe by the time I'm 50, but realistically, probably around 55 or so, I should hit that. So.
Oh, I love the idea that you're on an upward trajectory and thinking you're continuing upward past your mid-50s.
That's great. In terms of like the strength goals I've actually applied to myself in terms of my progress towards them, I'm farther ahead now at 48 than I was at any other point in my life. You know, and in terms of physiology and lifestyle, I don't see any reason why that should even start to go down. Maybe when I hit my 60s or 70s. I mean, at some point, I know it will, like your ability to recover, all that kind of stuff. You just have to train a little bit differently. But I mean, there's grip athletes. Old Hagen likes set one of the records with the inch, and he's his 50s, mid 50s now, or something like that. He's probably older than that. He's probably 60s or 70s. But anyway, yeah, so there's a lot of old time strongmen who stayed strong for many, many years into their 50s and 60s and beyond. So,
well, good. Good. Yeah. Well, that's great. Okay. So anti-fragile. I mean, one of the things that, you know, I worry about, and then I see it happening to me, you know, and I watched it happen to my parents, and I can see it happen to the, you know, people that I train with as they become more fragile. I mean, that's not the word that we use, but it's true that, you know, they get injured more easily, they recover more slowly. And so when I hear the word anti-fragile, I think, oh, I'd like that.
Yeah.
What does that mean to you?
Yeah. So the formal definition, it goes back to Nassim Taleb's book called Anti-Fragile, Things That Gain from Disorder, which it's a heavy, in-depth read. I would recommend it, but I wouldn't say not the most enjoyable read per se. But it was fascinating to me how I literally made it through a master's in mechanical engineering, like the advanced study of how shit breaks, and like no one bothered to tell me about the concept of anti-fragility, which I thought was just weird. So if you have things that are fragile, right, like a crystal glass, I apply even just too much stress to it, boom, it's going to fracture. It's going to be a complete mess. Now I can have things that are more what we could say is maybe robust. I can take a Tupperware container. I can drop it on the floor a bunch of times. It still looks like a Tupperware container. It's not going to shatter into 1,000 pieces. But it's not going to get better from that stress that's applied to it. So the idea of something being anti-fragile is if we apply a stressor to it, not only can it resist that stress and not break into 1,000 pieces, physiologically, it'll actually get a little bit better if we apply the right amount of stress. And it turns out that most living systems are actually anti-fragile. If you take the case of like your right bicep, if you go do some bicep curls, yeah, if we look at a micro level, we may see some muscle tears, we may see some trauma, calcium gets all disrupted. We see these changes that occur that literally look like destruction. And on some level it is. But if we come back 24, 48, 72 hours within a period of time later, then we could measure it. It's tiny, but the muscle's a little bit better. Those fibers are a little bit stronger, and everything is all nice and cleaned up and looks much more like we would expect a muscle to do. The funny part is if we didn't know how it operates and we did, let's say, some super heavy bicep curls. I did this on a cruise ship like, God, 4 years ago now. Buddy of mine, huge arms. So he's like, hey, we're going to train arms on the ship. A buddy of mine from the Kerrig Institute. I'm like, only nerds like this would I bother training on a 7-day cruise, you know, through the Caribbean or wherever we're going. I'm like, all right, great. So we did these crazy drop sets up to 45 pounds all the way up the rack and all the way back down. And like the next day, I like can't get my hand, my hair or anything like that. My arms are sore for like literally the whole time. But if you were to measure my bicep at that point, you would see lots of destruction of tissue. And so your first gut reaction would be, well, you idiot, what did you do? Like, look at this muscle before and look at it 24 hours later. It's like destroyed. This is the dumbest thing ever. But if you come back, in my case, maybe 2 weeks later, like, oh, wait a minute, it's all good again. And if we can measure it, it's just a little bit stronger, right? So we added stress to the system. The stress actually had some disorder, right? It looked like a mess if we looked at it 24 hours later. But if we come back in an appropriate amount of time, if I were to do that exact same training routine again, I would still be sore and I would still have some disruption, but not nearly to the level I had initially. Why? Because my body has gained from that disorder. It's now a little bit better. It's more anti-fragile than it was beforehand. And so the concept to me has just been fascinating how living systems, if you apply a little bit of stress, they actually get better. So my Tupperware container, no matter how many times I drop it, it's never going to get better at that stress. It might be able to handle that for, you know, thousands of cycles, but it's not going to get better from it. Where physiology literally gets better from the right amount of stress.
Well, that sounds a lot like more than just the concept of being resilient. This idea of getting better,
right,
I think, is the addition to the old concept of being resilient. Well, that's really interesting. And it sounds like there's more to it than just what we've all been hearing about, you know, exercise, and you do some exercise and then you recover and then you get stronger over time, you know, the progressive overload type of an idea. It sounds like it applies to lots of things in our body. Our bodies are these complex machines that have lots of systems operating all at the same time. I know that, you know, like my body can burn fat and my body can burn carbohydrates. And sometimes it's better to burn fat and sometimes it's better to burn carbohydrates. And my body, when I was born, my body was good at that. But over my life, maybe because of aging to some extent, you know, things break down, but also maybe because of disuse, right? Mm-hmm. If I don't use my bicep shrinks because my body says, well, I don't need that. But maybe my not using flexibility in what I eat and have to digest and use for fuel, or flexibility in you know, how much oxygen I have in my body, or, and I don't know what all of the different areas are. My guess is that you could share some of your knowledge about that with us.
Yeah. So when I was doing my research on metabolic flexibility, after it was like probably 4 years into that process, I was like, okay, so as we talked about last time on the show, we can increase our metabolic flexibility. We can get better at using carbohydrates on one end, can downregulate and get better at using fat on the other end. And we can effectively switch back and forth between the two, a la metabolically flexible. So if you go to do a really, really hard interval session, you want the ability to use carbohydrates for maximal performance. For just hanging out, like right now, having this conversation, you know, you don't need high levels of ATP or energy. So fat is going to be a much, much more efficient fuel for that. We don't need a lot of energy right away. So can you switch back and forth between those two? I started thinking, I'm like, okay, that's cool, but can we extend that concept based on the kind of anti-fragility concept to the entire body? All right, so the phrase I coined, which is just kind of a made-up term, just called physiologic flexibility. So if we take these same ideas, how can you adapt to the ends of the spectrum, go from one end back and forth to the other end? I think you can increase something I call like your HDR, human dynamic range, right? If you look at high level performance, it's almost always about how fast can you change direction, right? So sprinting, you're going from zero to super, super fast on 100 meters. American football, you're looking at a receiver, you know, defensive player, whatever. How fast can the running back change direction in the face of a defender? All right, you look about older people, like falling is a huge risk, right? How fast can you restabilize your body, right? You went from standing, not moving to, whoa, like almost falling over in that instant reaction to try to hold your position and come back to a baseline, right? So it's all about how fast can you make transitions? And if that's true, right, just like metabolic flexibility, transitioning from fats to carbohydrates back and forth, then the next question is, okay, that's cool, great, nice concept. But what systems would you apply it to? Like, how do you make any of that practical? And the thought process I had with that is I think your physiology is based on survival, that we're literally hardwired to do everything possible in order to survive. So if that's true, then we should come up with some hierarchy based on survival of things that are much, much higher rate, right? So if you look at digestion, like, do you need at some point to digest food? Absolutely. But if you're old school paleo man and you're running from a saber-toothed tiger, who gives a crap about digestion, right? That goes right out the window. You better be able to run pretty fast and get away, right? So some things, yeah. Are they needed? Yes. Are they going to be a rate limiter in case of survival? Maybe at some point, but there's a lot of other things that could be higher on the list. So what I did then is I used survival as going to be the mechanism of how we would rate these systems. So within that, then you've got systems that have to control what are called homeostatic processes, right? Homeostasis is your body just wants to keep even keel of different systems. So the simple one to think about is temperature, right? So we've all been told body temperature is 98.6 Fahrenheit. Turns out it's actually 97.7. I'm the only one nerdy enough to actually pull the research that didn't even trust what temperature you're supposed to be at. And it'll vary a little bit per individual. But it's very, very tightly regulated. If you look at core body temperature, you go more than a few degrees high or a few degrees low, it's lights out, that's it. You're pushing up daisies in a lot somewhere, you're done. So we have all these different processes that then has to try to hold core temperature. And because we have these adaptive processes, we could go in and do a hot sauna. You could exercise in the heat. You could go into a steam room. You could exercise during a humid place. You can actually be exposed to relatively, really cold water for longer than most people think. Granted, you may have some loss of limb function and potential drowning, but from a functional standpoint, you could still exist for, you know, several minutes to possibly even longer. Why? Because your body can generate more heat. And if we have movement available, we can do that. We can shiver. So we have these adaptive processes that allow us to keep this really, really tight range on what's called these homeostatic processes. So I then said, okay, if we want homeostasis, great. There's tons of systems of body that regulate homeostasis. Okay, can we put them in terms of rank of survival? Because at the end, I'm like, how do I make any of this actionable, right? Because the question is, it's like, oh, that's great, Mr. Nerd, but what do I actually do? Like, can you give me some direction of things I should actually focus on? Because the internet's not short of like 1700 things you're supposed to be doing before you even get out of bed in the morning, of what toothpaste you're supposed to use. You're supposed to be, have this IR light, don't get this sunlight, don't wear this clothes, you know, cover your nut sacks, you're going to get EMF and, you know, whatever else is going on. So I said, okay, temperature is number one, right? We have to regulate temperature. Great. pH would be number two. The body has to operate, can't be too acidic, can't be too basic. It has to be, you know, just a little bit above a pH of 7. If that goes awry any direction, all these little chemical cascades and enzymes and all these things that work, they all just get completely screwed and you're dead, right? And we see that in the hospital. Someone has a very bad infection or gets septic, their pH can drift too far, and then that's a marker for, okay, you're done at that point. However, we've got all these, again, mechanisms built in. So if you go do 30 seconds on the rower and you have a lot of what's classically called lactic acid, which is lactate plus hydrogen ions, you are literally dumping acid into your muscles. Can you then buffer that? Because if you do that too much, we don't want to dump a bunch of acid into the bloodstream and change our pH. So we have all these systems built in place that'll, one, limit exercise performance so you don't generate too much, and then we'll try to buffer those. Then real quickly, the last two would be fuel systems, right? So sort of metabolic flexibility. Did you go from carbohydrates on one end to the extreme end would be fat, and then even on into ketones in the case of like long-term fasting or what's classically called starvation. And then the very last one is just simply air. How do you regulate oxygen and CO2? If you can't regulate those two, then it's lights out and you're done. So those would be the four systems that then you break out into different action items that you can focus on. And the underpinning there is assuming that, you know, like we talked about last time, your nutrition and exercise is pretty decent, right? Obviously, those are going to be the two big things to focus on because they drive so many other mechanisms. But once you've got that and, you know, you're pretty good with that, like everyone's talking about longevity now. Okay, great. Well, what do you focus on then at that point? Some new crazy supplement and take this algae, do that, right? So my bias is that this gives you areas of then to work on. Once you increase the adaptive ability in each one of those areas, you are literally making your physiology more anti-fragile.
I wonder if it also, these things that you're talking about, do they give you some like windows into how healthy you are?
Yes.
You know, if you don't have, you know, metabolic flexibility, for example, I think that one is obvious. But, you know, like if you can't hold your breath for very long, you know, maybe that's a clue that something is off. Maybe it goes both ways, that it gives you clues as to your current status, but also pathways to improve your status.
Yeah, exactly. And Kelvin Davies, that's what his argument is, that we've got this range of how far we can push these homeostatic adaptations, and the higher headroom we have, right? So how we can raise that physiologic ceiling, that's going to, in theory, buy us longevity. And we know that those erode exactly what you said over time. Right? I remember visiting my grandma when she was in the nursing home. I think she passed away and she's 102. But for the last, you know, several years, you know, you always wonder, like, why do you walk into nursing homes? It's like 76 degrees in here all the time, right? It's because people who are older generally can't regulate their body temperature very high or very well. So they want that ambient temperature to be closer to 98.6, 97.7, because they have to do physically less work, right? Mm-hmm. And so why are they in there wearing afghans and, you know, hats and all sorts of stuff? They're losing the ability to regulate their body temperature. All right. And if you take them and you bring them outside and even just slight humidity, it's very hard. It's a very hard stressor on them. You start getting even below 70 degrees of just ambient air temperature, that you'll see them start to shiver, and they can't create enough heat, and it becomes very uncomfortable. Right. So we do lose in these areas over time.
Yeah. And you hear about when there's heat waves, that it's the elderly population that suffers the most.
Yep.
Yeah. So that makes really good sense. I have myself noticed that my tolerance for cold temperature, I used to enjoy the cold. I grew up in South Florida. So, you know, it's like cold is cool. You know, I love cold.
65 degrees, that's cold, man.
Yeah, it was exactly. And, you know, so it didn't really matter. I really liked it. But as I got older, I started hating the cold. And so I started doing, it actually was the worst thing I ever did, but I started taking ice cold showers. Mm-hmm. It was a part of it was a very long story to how did I end up doing that? Because I swore I'd never do any, it sounded like the worst thing, but I started doing that. And after a while, I stopped minding the cold so much. Mm-hmm. And so I don't know whether that was psychological or was there some physiological? What do you think?
I mean, I think it's probably both. So I grew up in Minnesota, right? So previous to COVID, I did a lot of traveling, so I wasn't home as much in Minnesota in the winter. So I can't say, you know, I was hanging out in the winter in the snowdrift all the time. But, you know, once COVID had, it was about, you know, 2 years of not traveling. So I'm here most of the winter. And I decided, I'm like, right before it happened, I ended up buying a freezer that I converted to cold water immersion.
Oh, my God.
You caulk all the inside of it. You put it on a temp sensor, unplug it before you get in, of course. And I thought, this would be a great experiment. You know, I'm kind of used to cold. It doesn't bother me too much. But man, getting in cold water feels different than air temperature. So I started off at just 50 degrees. I'm like, okay, I'm just going to make it nice and easy. 50 degrees for just 30 seconds. And I wanted to get out before it was difficult, right? Could I sit in there much longer and shiver and be horrible? Sure. But my goal was, can I do this almost literally every day? And so for over a year, probably 6 days out of 7 days, you know, got in the freezer right after doing more aerobic stuff in the morning. And what I found over time was, you know, I ended up getting down to, it's probably like 42, 43 degrees for about 5 minutes. And it was pretty easy. It was not hard. I wasn't shivering. I wasn't, you know, super uncomfortable. And the two things that stood out to me, one was that the adaptation process, I had to go relatively slow. I did this experiment recently where we were traveling, we were gone. Came back, I had to dump all the water out, put new water in, and I decided to run it at a much colder temperature. So I ran it like 38, 39, 40. Ooh. And it was hard to get past 60 seconds. Like, I could do it. If someone said, you have to stay in for 5 minutes, yeah, I could, you know, nut up and do it and be a little cold and shiver. But to get to the point where it was easy, it never really got easier there, right? It's like if you came to my place and you've never deadlifted before, it's like, oh, let's put 405 on the bar and I'm just going to yell at you to try harder. Right. Yeah, that's probably not like the best strategy. Like you can just take it down to 95 or 200 or wherever you're starting, 315. Doesn't matter. Right. But you can scale it to wherever your capacity is. So for cold, I found like starting much warmer than what you expect is easier. And then after doing it for, God, almost like a year and a half, by the time I just dropped down to doing it a couple times per week, my hypothesis going in was it'll get easier, right? I'll get used to the cold. I've grown up in Minnesota. This isn't that hard. But I realized literally every day, even now, after doing it for longer, like that second right before you get in, you're like, this is a stupid idea, right? This is part of your brain that's like, this is dumb. This is going to suck. What are you doing? You idiot, right? And those little thoughts, they got easier for sure, but they just never went away. I mean, I thought that they would, you know, after doing it almost daily for a year and a half, would go away. And I think part of that is because literally if you are in cold water too long, you will die, right? So this is kind of this old kind of part of the brain. I know neuroscience hate that when you say that, but the reptilian kind of limbic part of your brain that is literally hardwired for your survival, right? And it says, hey, remember, if you're in cold too long, it's a dumb idea because you could die. But we have the newer prefrontal cortex or the professor part of our brain that can talk us into all sorts of crazy shit for better or worse, right? So the new part of your brain can be like, oh, it's only temporary. You're in a controlled environment. You can easily get out. You're going to leave your hands out if you're super worried. You know, it's controlled. You're going to be fine. Right. And then you get out and you feel, oh, a lot better. Okay. That was good. But that little limbic part, Dr. Huberman calls it limbic friction, which I like, it never went away. Right. It's there's some things that are just hardwired where, yep, you can still override it, but it's going to take a little bit of effort and a little bit of go do it type thing.
Yeah, let's talk more about that. That's not just limited to getting your stupid ass into freezing cold water.
It's with anything that's hard.
It's like I shouldn't eat that extra bowl of ice cream. Like I want it.
Yeah,
you know,
calories. They're wired for calories,
I'm not supposed
man.
To. Calories yeah, I mean, rare. I want that thing. I want that, or you know, whatever it is. And I don't know whether it's addiction, dopamine type related stuff, or, you know, it's these instincts type thing, but maybe you've got some tricks for, you know, helping people who they want to do things, you know, let's just set aside whether they're smart or not, but they want to do things and they've got these voices in their head that say, do it, or don't do it. That's stupid.
Mm-hmm.
And, but they, you know, they've thought it through or they've got advice from somebody who's, you know, pretty wise and they just are having a hard time making themselves do this thing. What do you help people? How do you help people do that?
Yeah. If I'm honest, I charge them a lot of money. I've hired other coaches that I've paid thousands of dollars to. Why? Because it's hard, and left to my own devices, I wasn't freaking doing it, right? So if I'm paying someone for their advice, I've got skin in the game, and so now I'm accountable. Now they're going to call me on my own BS, and it's costing me money, right? No one wants to burn money, right? So I think that's obviously one way. But independent of that, a couple of things
I've
found.
So accountability is one thing.
Yeah, accountability. And again, this could be a pool with your friends. It doesn't necessarily have to be a coach per se. Other couple of things I found is, I'm a bigger fan of frequency, but easier, right? So a lot of times with new clients, they'll be like, oh, just tell me what to do. Give me the list of 17 things. I'll do it. And in the past, I was like, great, here's your 17 things. And then a week goes by and they've only done like five of them. And then they feel bad and then you're mad. And so do less than what you think. And then when they complain, I got this from Krista Scott Dixon of like, okay, if I only gave you five things and you wanted 20, show me that you can do the five things, right? You got 2 weeks. I want 90% compliance. Show me. And what they then realize is, oh yeah, this is harder than I thought, right? Because a lot of times our eyes are kind of bigger than what we can actually do. So I'm a bigger fan of whatever it is, do it more often, but make it easier. So when I was trying to get into just doing rowing most mornings, I literally started with the goal of like, I will sit on the rower 5 out of 7 days per week. And I don't even care if I row more than 30 seconds. It's not the point. The point is I have to wander out into my garage and sit on there, turn it on, sync the device and do something. Right. And then it was, okay, let's do a minute. Let's do 2 minutes. Let's do 6 minutes. Right. So I'll scale up the amount of time. So with cold water, even on, I still do this. I just did this the other day of like, okay, I'm at this temp. You know, I should be around, 3 to 5 minutes. I'm like, man, I don't want to do this today. This is a horrible idea. And your brain goes through all the excuses of, I'm tired, I had less calories, I didn't sleep well last night. And I'm like, okay, so can I make it easier? So my goal is just get in and get control of my breath. When I get control of my breath, I can get out. And normally what you find at that point is, oh, wow, this is okay, this is easier. I ended up saying like 2 minutes, right? So I lowered the bar to entry to make it to something that you can do. And then once you're doing it, it's not so bad, right? So for a lot of clients, it's like, okay, like when I first started, especially with more general pop, I literally had clients like, okay, text me a picture of yourself with the gym check-in person. I don't even care if you do anything at the gym. They're like, what are you insane? Like, why am I paying you all this money? This is the dumbest thing ever. I'm like, okay, how many times, Bob, have you gone to the gym last year? Oh, none. Okay, great. So one, you've already won. Right. And lo and behold, what they find is, oh, I went to the gym. You know, I thought I'd do some bicep curls and, you know, oh, I actually changed clothes today. And so it was getting them over the hump of just getting there, but making it easier. Right. Because we've all had this, like, you're like, oh, my God, Monday is this horrible hour and a half training session. It's just going to suck. It's going to be so bad. And you build this thing up so high that you just need so much momentum to get over it that all of a sudden skipping becomes like a legitimate option. Versus,
yeah,
even with my own training now, it's like, okay, can I do 5 to 6 days a week? If I can do that, my goal is just to show up. You know, like today, we literally had to drive back from my parents' house this morning. So they had a tornado happen. We had a bunch of trees down. Uh-huh. They're all safe. Everything's fine. But I literally had 25 minutes to train today between stuff going on. But I'm fortunate. I built my life around this. I have a garage gym. So I just had to walk out. I did some heavy deadlifts and a couple other things, and that was it. But in the past, I would have not done that at all. I would have been like, oh my God, my normal training schedule is all screwed. Let's just eat birthday cake instead, right? So it's literally going, okay, what can I do today? What can I get out? I'll take whatever I can get from my performance, and then I'll start again tomorrow. And if you just do that frequency, that violent consistency over time, it gets easier, but I think just lowering the bar to your expectation, you'll get a lot more done.
So consistency, lower the bar enough so that you can just do it all the time. And I guess the second part is then that it's that the bar is low enough that it's not really a suffering thing.
Right.
It's a, you know, I'm going to do this thing and there's no reason not to because it's not that big of a deal. And I just get in the habit of doing it. And then once I'm doing it, like, let's say I wanted to do cold showers, the idea of I'm going to go right now and take all my clothes off and get in the shower that's ice cold, that would be very hard.
Mm-hmm.
But if I'm already in the shower,
because
I got to take a shower in the morning, and all I'm going to do is like turn it on cold for 5 seconds at one point in there, well, surely I can do that. Is this sort of the idea that you're talking about?
Yeah, I like that. And James Clear calls it like habit stacking, right? So for people for cold water immersion, they're like, I don't have a crazy freezer in my garage. I'm not doing that. I'm like, okay, just turn it to cold for 5 to 10 seconds. Like you're literally, you're probably going to shower, right? So whenever you shower, exactly what you said, you're literally turning the dial like hot has to go to cold first and then off. So your goal is just before you think about it, you just stop on cold. And I've had clients do this now more often. And it's so funny. Like somebody just emailed me a couple days ago. They're like, yeah, I got in. I totally forgot. I didn't want to do my cold shower, but I was so used to doing it for like over the past, year, they were up to doing a couple minutes that their hand literally turned and stopped at the cold button before they realized their brain realized what they were doing, which is perfect. Right. So you want that action tied to something else you're already going to do. Right. So adding a cold shower is for cold is usually where I have people start.
Okay. So even if, because you hear about, cold water immersion is, got longevity benefits, that sort of thing. It's like, maybe. But and 10 seconds of cold maybe doesn't have longevity benefits, but what it is helping you to do is get control over yourself,
mm-hmm.
So that you can do 15 seconds and then 20 seconds and then it's 2 minutes and maybe you are starting to get some health benefits from that, but you're not trying to be perfect. You're just trying to get better over time. And what's the rush? Just get better and better, right?
Yeah. And I think, so one of the reasons I got into cold exposure was for that reason, right? Because in reality, my life is probably too easy, right? When I do online work, right? I hit two buttons, Chipotle shows up at my door, right? I mean, I don't have to really do much of anything. Like most of what I do for exercise is simulated work, but I know enough about physiology to know that if I don't do anything, everything's going to go backwards, right? I'm not even going to stay where I'm at. It takes effort to stay neutral, right? People think that if I don't do anything, I'll stay in neutral. Like I put my car in neutral, I'll keep moving. Nope. At some point you stop moving and you literally start sliding backwards like really fast. So I know I have to do some things. But I wanted something that was hard that I could do every day, right? Because maybe I could do some hard exercise for short periods of time. There's some isometrics. There's some stuff I could do there. But the setup and the warm up and everything else. And what I found with the cold was that I got to practice those neural circuits all the time. Having my prefrontal cortex, you know, override my lizard limbic system. And that will then transfer to other areas, right? So as you get better at doing that, you kind of learn those circuits and learn that I think that's a practice skill, or what they call neuroplastic skill, that then transfers to, oh, wow, okay, I'm going to take the stairs up. Okay, I'm going to park farther away today. Oh, it's kind of hot. I think I'm actually going to exercise outside and not in the air-conditioned gym, right? You'll start finding yourself automatically kind of making decisions that is literally putting yourself into stress. Because the way your physiology is wired is it's not wired to want to go into stress. We can change that over time, but the reality is you're wired to sit on your butt, hit two buttons, and have fast food show up at your door, right? Your brain is wired for efficiency. Because if we didn't get a huge amount of calories in a short period of time, we died, right? And so we're trying to now use these newer parts of our brain circuit literally to talk to the caveman part of ourselves to change what we're doing.
Right. Okay, well, that is very helpful. I mean, to add on to the old school stuff, which is like, you know, if you're going to hit the gym on your way home from work, well, make sure you put the bag in the car, because if you get to if you have to come home first, you're never going to go back out to go to the gym, kind of a thing. But anyway, this is a way of training yourself to have better control over your behavior. I wonder if I know that you do. I actually took your certification for the MetFlex certification, and that really made a big difference for me. And I recommend everybody look into that. It's the metabolic flexibility stuff, and I think you have another one for your physiologic, and we'll ask you to tell us all about that. But I wonder if there's any sort of like general advice that you could give. Again, we're talking about the older athlete here, so that you know you don't have to encourage people to get off the couch and get some exercise, but things that they could do that we haven't already talked about that would be good. They'd be smart, you know. Aside from like hire a coach, but you know, things that just would be, in your opinion, sensible for a person who's looking to fight off this fragility that sort of comes on naturally or whatever, why ever it happens, I don't know, but it happens. And so, you know, what can we do to fight that off as long as we can?
Yeah, so there's a couple things. So one of them we talked about is some type of different temperature exposure. That can be hot or cold, either one. Just start with whatever feels good. Doesn't matter to me. Some way of altering your pH. So a simple way would be some type of high intensity interval training. You know, if you're proficient at running, this could be running. My bias is using a rower or a bike if you don't want a lot of the impact on your joints. And literally just get on there and go hard for 20, 30, maybe 40 seconds. Right, you want to try to get as high as you can to a max heart rate. Again, warm up beforehand, of course. And people always ask, well, do I take 220 minus my age to figure out my max heart rate? It's a highly variable. It's a good start. But just get an old school heart rate strap and just monitor it. right? So if you hit 174, great. Next week, all of a sudden, now you hit 176. Great. Your max is now 176, right? It's not that it magically probably increased. It's just you exercise a little harder to get it to there. And whatever number you get is going to be your max, right? So you can try to get at least 90% of that max a couple times. 20, 30, 40 seconds. That will dump a lot of acid into your bloodstream, and you will have to buffer that. I just got done doing a podcast with Dr. Keith Barr, and he was saying that so high intensity interval training like that, they did a study looking at how many genes are turned on in younger people and older people. I can't remember what age it was at. But he said it literally turns on the same number of genes, right? And that makes sense, right? If we're talking about survival, if the saber-toothed tiger all of a sudden shows up, like you better be able to run super fast away from it. And we would want some positive adaptations from that for survival. Another one would be, like we talked about, carbohydrates to maybe ketosis or fat, right? So pick a period of time, like we talked about last time, do some fasting. I think that's useful. You know, it could be once every 3 weeks, could be just one day a week. It doesn't have to be every day by any means. It can be pretty simple. Last two would be some type of difference between carbon dioxide and oxygen. This could be a Wim Hof type protocol for breathing. This could be aerobic training. It could be wherever you, whatever you want, right? To consume a higher amount of oxygen, like your VO2 max, which people are familiar with, and then get used to that feeling of like you can't breathe fast enough to get rid of CO2, right? That sensation of that it's just hard to catch your breath. Yeah, do that once in a while. I think that's a good thing. And the last thing, which is not really in the cert, would be do some recreation and ideally learn some new sport. The more complex it is and the more you're dealing with an outside environment, the better. So it could be golf, could be tennis, basketball. Obviously, I'm going to say kiteboarding, surfing, because you're interacting with the board. Kiteboarding, you've got a big sail, so to speak, right? Kite that you have to interact with the environment. And if you think about all the things, like if you just take tennis, right? Think of all the different things you'd have to master in your body, the movement, the hand-eye coordination, tracking the ball, force production, all of those things. They just use parts of your brain that almost never get tapped extensively with other exercises. Right. From, you know, cerebellar coordination, vestibular system, eye movements, you know, things like eye tracking, convergence, etc. The analogy I use is, have you ever heard of the sea slug? So a sea slug is this little critter that floats through the ocean. And once it finds a rock, it attaches itself to said rock. And that's where it lives the rest of its life. It never leaves its rock. And then it promptly eats its own brain. Because like I don't have to move, right? Food's gonna come back to me. I don't even have to literally move. So what? I don't need a brain, right? And if you look at the neuroscience of how much part of our brain is just designed for movements of all type, right? If you can't move towards food, you're gonna be dead, or move away from food, you're dead then too, right? So I think just, you know, learn Brazilian jiu-jitsu, learn to kiteboard, golf, tennis. I don't even care what it is, right? Just work those circuits and just do something that you're going to struggle a little bit at in a safe manner.
So this, you're saying that this is going to help us not eat our brains and keep our brains vital so that we can not just have, you know, physical anti-fragility, but mental brain power.
Yeah. Like a lot of the newer studies have shown huge correlation between, so some of the old studies were done in rats, which has been replicated, I think, with MRI in humans, that just old school aerobic training increases the size of your hippocampal volume, right? So this special area in your brain literally gets bigger from just doing aerobic exercise. Muscles themselves create something called BDNF, so brain-derived neurotrophic factor. That actually appears to be primarily created in the muscle, flows through the bloodstream, and then goes into your brain and literally starts creating new circuits. So how we move and our brain are like super, super connected. And if you think about what happens as people get older, they generally lose coordination of that, right? They move their head real fast and all of a sudden they get dizzy, right? Is that vestibular issue? Is it the eye movement? Is it all the above? So learning new things just increases the conductivity from different parts of the brain too. And plus it's another way just to stay active, right? You know, just do some movement that's fun and that you have to learn a little bit at the same time.
Wow. Wow. What a tip. I have a question that only a bodybuilding brainiac is going to be able to answer. You hear that older people need to eat more protein. They get anabolic resistance, mm-hmm. you know, that whole thing. And sarcopenia happens. You see it happen. You know it happens. It's going to happen. It's going to happen to me if I'm not careful about it. And to fight that off, I want to eat more protein. Okay. On the other hand, you hear, well, be careful you don't have any more protein than you need because that accelerates aging, don't you know? What's the real poop here?
I would say now, based on the data that we know, right, and there's some Scandinavian yeah. studies looking at sort of the top three things out of studies that come out as predictors of longevity, right? So lower body strength and muscle mass, right? Those two mm-hmm. are pretty highly correlated to each other. So you yeah. kind of throw them together, right? So exactly what you said, muscle mass. Number two is aerobic capacity, VO2 max, yeah. like huge yeah. impact on longevity, massive. Number three is actually grip strength. Now, grip strength in those studies, you could argue, was just a rough indicator of full body strength. But my bias is I think all those are two-way streets, meaning my hypothesis would be that if you increase your grip strength, you're probably going to increase your longevity, right? We know that's true for VO2 max. We know that's true for lower body strength and muscle mass. So those are things we've got pretty good data on. So if those are all related to strength and muscle, I would 100% hedge my bets in that direction. And the acute studies do show that, I think it was Tang that did a study comparing 20 grams of whey and 40 grams of whey. Young people, 20 grams of whey was enough to get this nice acute response to take amino acids and stuff them into muscle tissue to get it a little bit bigger and stronger. And older people, they needed 40 grams. And older people in that study, I believe, was a mean age of 71. They needed 40 grams at once to get that same effect. So in older people, you need like what I use as a 4x40 approach, right? Four meals at probably 40 grams of protein each. And we know that that's going to help retain muscle, probably even add muscle. You know, how long can we do that? All the new research kind of keeps bumping that ceiling up higher than what we thought before. And again, it's hard to use population studies because, you know, not your listeners, but, you know, 99% of people wandering through airports and malls are not doing that, right? So general population definitely headed down the wrong direction. The mTOR signaling effects from protein and longevity, those are a lot of animal studies. And if you're, you know, an earthworm, yeah, probably makes pretty damn big difference. As you scale up and level of mammals, it appears to make less and less difference, right? Hmm. And so there's been two studies that were done looking at some of the nutrition stuff with, I think it was chimpanzees, I believe, and the data is kind of murky. One of them, I think, was looking at more of a caloric restriction model. What they found out was that one of the people who was taking care of the animal care felt bad for the monkeys and was secretly feeding some of the monkeys. So that kind of destroyed a multi-million dollar, you know, multiple year experiment. You know, and even then you're left with the question of, does that really scale the humans? So most of the data I've seen on that side is highly mechanistic and not replicated in humans. And then you get into the mess of, are we talking about pathologies? Or are we talking about normal, healthy people? Right, with in terms of top risks of, like, say, cancer, like maybe some types of cancer, if you have them already, might they be accelerated by protein? Maybe that's not my area of research. But to then extrapolate and say that, oh, well, that's going to apply to healthy people, that's like a completely different realm entirely, right? And the little bit I know about cancer research shows that the things that are good for healthy people are almost like cancer is like the bizarro world, or almost the inverse, right? Because cancer, you've got too many cells that are replicating too fast, right? So things to slow down cell replication is probably going to be beneficial for a cancer treatment. If you take a normal, healthy human and you slow down replication, now you've just slowed down all their regenerative properties, and that's probably not going to be the best. again, I'm like way out of my research in that area, and that's kind of hypothetical. But yeah, so I, for me personally, yeah, I don't worry about protein. You know, if I was 85 years old now, I would be probably eating more protein, right? And so for my parents, my grandparents, anyone else, right, as of now, I would recommend probably more protein. I'm going to hedge my bets on, you know, staying as functional and adding as much and keeping as much muscle mass as you can for as long as you can.
I like that advice. Well, thank you for that.
Yeah.
Let me ask Glenn here if he's got any questions for you, and then we'll
he's been too quiet.
You, tell us. I'm just listening to all the good stuff I'm hearing because you've wandered down my area with the cancer type stuff. So that was kind of nice. But
yeah, maybe you have more info on that. I mean, like, again, like I said, that's well outside my wheelhouse.
Yeah. Well, this whole, all the studies coming out now are just like, they're just, wow, I didn't know that. Like the one about, the funny thing is, I'll tell you a funny story, how I got into the protein kick some years ago, and basically I had chickens in my backyard. I had a pair of goats, and I was drinking the goat's milk, and I was having the eggs. So I was getting fresh eggs and fresh milk and everything else. And then I read T. Colin Campbell's book, and I was like, oh, great. 12%. So I realized that maybe I was on the wrong track after all. But I think it comes down to, I would look at it from the point of a balanced diet, you know, not too high in fats, not too high in carbs, not too high in protein, but basically a balanced diet. And the foods that are present in nature, the foods that I try to eat from primarily, whether it be the goats in the backyard or whether it be the chicken or the duck eggs now I use. So, but yeah.
Yeah. And I think that's valid, right? And if someone really pushed me and said, hey, man, like, I kind of buy you on protein, but I'm still like super worried about it. You know, what I do with them is like, okay, let's do one 24-hour fast once a week. Mm-hmm. Right. And, and then this is hypothetical, but I'm like, yeah, you know, if you spend the last 30 years as a bodybuilder eating every couple hours, like whacking, you know, anabolism as high as possible, I agree. There might be some risk somewhere that's hypothetical. So, you know, if body comp becomes an issue, insulin signaling, using fat all as a fuel, hey, let's just have you do one fast for 24 hours, just consume some water and electrolytes, no amino acids, whatever. I don't think you're going to see much of a negative impact on muscle. Might you hedge your bets a little bit towards autophagy and some of these other regulating things? And then further down the hypothetical path, like some of Walter Longo's stuff, if you, you know, quarterly want to do a 3 to 7 day fast, yeah, maybe. You know, I do think you have to be a little bit more worried about loss of muscle mass with some of that. But again, you know, hypothetical, and everyone has to kind of figure out where they're on the spectrum, you know, where they're going to hedge their bets and, you know, what they're going to do related to it. And last part too on autophagy is that one of the highest things I've seen upregulate AMPK and just autophagy in general was absolutely brutal high intensity intervals on depleted muscle glycogen, meaning you would get up in the morning, fasted, do some heinous, like horrible intervals. You would not then eat for several hours, or you would do it the night before and only have protein. And then you would repeat it again on low levels of carbohydrates stored in both the liver and the muscle. That'll upregulate AMPK for almost 5 days. Again, high amounts of stress, probably not something you want to do a lot. But if people are really into AMPK and autophagy and that kind of stuff, there's other ways you can get at some of those mechanisms that might even be superior.
Got it. So extra recovery. But
oh, it's horrible. It'll tank your HRV. You'll feel like dog crap. It's not any fun.
Yeah. I haven't done much fasted exercise, but the little bit that I have done was really terrible.
Yeah.
Well, fantastic. Dr. Mike, thank you. Thank you again.
Thanks, guys.
This is the second time, and you're just so full of wisdom. I wonder, tell us and our audience here how they can find you, how they can learn more about you and your programs, that sort of thing.
Yeah, so most information you can find, the main website is just miketnelson.com. And then if you want information on the certifications, the best place is flexdiet.com, FLEXDIET.com. Both those places, you'll be able to get on the wait list or the newsletter. So probably 95% of the info I have goes out to the newsletter, which is just free to sign up. So hop on there and you can hit reply, ask me any questions, and then tell me you heard me on this podcast here, and we'll send you another free gift too.
Like that.
Thank you very much, gentlemen. You have a good evening.
Yeah, thank you guys so much. Appreciate it.
Thank you much.
Alrighty. Bye-bye. Thank you so much for listening into my discussion about metabolic and physiologic flexibility with Dr. Mike T. Nelson. You can find more information about Dr. Mike in the show notes. While you're there, you can sign up to take a free fitness practices assessment, send us a question to address on the podcast, see all of our episodes, subscribe to our podcast, and you can sign up for our newsletter. If you enjoyed this episode, please share it with your friends. That'd be a great help. Thanks again.